Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
The Rock Island Independence football franchise has come up quite a bit in our studies of the early professional football in this series, and it seems like many of the big games and better teams of the 1920s were contending against this group. So who were the Rock Island Independence? Well, we hope to find out this and more in this edition on a series of early professional football teams in part one on Rock Island.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And as we look back at that window of football history, we find out that many teams back in the early 20th century were clubs and organizations and even neighborhood sandlot teams. And one of those that sprung up in that time was the Rock Island Independence. And this is the first of a two-part series that we're going to do on Rock Island. And we're going to get into some great detail on the origins and early playing dates and some of the games and people that were on the team from that early Rock Island team. Now, the game was generally, like we said, sandlot teams, and teams were and players were just blowing off a little bit of steam by men that loved to play the game. And generally, the members were all associated together through a club or worked together, or they congealed as a group to play ball. Now, since the Rock Island team was not affiliated with any organizations, clubs, or business sponsors, like most other teams of the era, they called themselves the Independents. Now, the Rock Island Argus newspaper, in a clip seen on PigskinDispatch.com on the article in question, first calls the Independents out by name on October 13th, 1902 in an article. That article recants a victory by the Rock Island team over their opponent, the Davenport Standards, by a score of 6-0. The Argus piece also gives a brief look at some of the early roster members of the Independents team. M. Allweiler played center, and left guard was Jay Wright and left tackle M. Harder. E. Colligan wrapped up the end of the left side, while E. Bloomquist, L. Swanson, and W. Fowler played the right side of the line of guard, tackle, and end, respectfully. Now, the backfield makeup had W. Stremla quarterback, W. Karse as the left halfback, and O. Oberg at right halfback, and manning the fullback position was H. Battles. Great piece by the Argus back 120-some years ago. Now, the website rockislandindependence.com shares quite a bit about the football club and its origins. It's a really great site, really well done. I suggest that you go and take a look at it. We have a link to it on Pigskin Dispatch for this part one of the Rock Island Independence post that we have here today. And that site claims that the information was spotty, but iterations of the Independents were in the records for 1902-1903 season, 1907-1909, and in 1912, at least early on. And the Independents were a competitive team in some of those seasons, such as in 1907, they finished with 2 wins and 1 loss and 3 ties and outscored their opponents 82-12. In 1908, they were undefeated in 4 games. In 1909, the team only organized for 3 games. However, they were smothered by their opponents in all 3. So not a very good season in that one. By the time 1912 rolled around, the Independents seemed to have a more formal organizational structure when Jack Roche took over the control of the team as team manager. They went undefeated that year with an 8-0 record and were crowned the champions of the state of Illinois. The following year, Roche added Walter Flanagan as not only the starting left end, but as an assistant manager, as well as the record of the Independents. It was still stellar at 6-0-1. And this managing duel stuck together for 1914 and finished the season with a 5-2 mark. Games with the rival Moline Indians in the Davenport Athletic Club were the toughest competition in this time frame. In 1915, Roche apparently stepped down as Flanagan took over full control and a 5-1-1 record proceeded for the Independents. Perhaps there was a bit of a falling out between the two? Well, we'll get to that in just a second. It gets a little bit confusing in 1916 as Jack Roche, who left the team, started a Rock Island squad in addition to the one that Walter Flanagan had control of. With two teams starting the season, there was confusion and scheduling issues. Eventually, several of Roche's men deserted after he failed to secure a second game. Now, Roche and Flanagan struck a deal, and Flanagan's 11 were able to pick up the Independents' name and the rights to the field which Roche has secured for his home games. All indications are, though, that Flanagan owned the team from 1916 through the 1925 seasons. Well, the team started out at 6-0 in 1917, and game requests from other squads around the land were pouring in, many of which Flanagan denied. The gate draw attendance for home games was virtually always in the thousands of paid onlookers in Rock Island, and Flanagan wanted to schedule a game with a team that everybody knew. He tried to schedule the famous Fort Wayne Friars, but that game plan sort of fell through, and across the river, though, was a nationally recognized team that had beaten the rival Davenport Athletic Club 40-0 earlier in the season. So Flanagan invited that same team for a game in Rock Island. Now, the American Football Fandom website, with a great link, they have some great information on there too. We have a link to them on Pigskin Dispatch for this article, says that things started to get really interesting when Flanagan penciled in two games against that team from across the river, the Minneapolis Marines, who many considered one of the toughest teams in the Midwest. And it really put Rock Island on the map, even getting them on their schedule in the football world, and even garnered them some real national attention. Rock Island lost to the Marines by a narrow margin of 7-3 in game one. However, when they traveled over into Minneapolis, they were soundly defeated by a wider margin, 33-7, in that second game in Minneapolis. Well, these games and the taste of being competitive, Flanagan started really recruiting players from outside the Illinois area. The First World War interrupted the progress of growth that he had started here, and it looked as it did for most things in life with that great war, World War I. But in the post-war and post-disease of the Spanish flu being over in 1919 season, the Independents' plans were back on track with Walter Flanagan in charge. In 1919, Walter Flanagan hired a man by the name of Rube Ursula, formerly of that same Minnesota Marines team they played a few years earlier. He served as the player coach for Rock Island. And though the team carried little or no nationally recognized players prior to the season, Flanagan's passion to win, organizational skills, and overall reputation of being a good football manager may have been a big factor in the decision for Ursula to come to Rock Island. In the process, Rube brought several other good Minneapolis players with him to Rock Island. And that season, the Independents came out of the gate fast with two easy victories. Their next opponent was an all-star team from Hammond, Indiana, the Hammond Pros, who were dubbed the $20,000 team, sporting so many stars on their roster that they couldn't possibly get them all on the field at the same time. Now, this team featured a couple of stars, including a guy by the name of George Halas that had recently had a big game in a Rose Bowl on a military team that he played for. The contest was closely played, with the two evenly matched squads in front of 7,000 fans at Douglas Park near Rock Island. However, the Independents gave up a late score in the fourth quarter and lost the game by the score of 12-7. What a heartbreaker there. And the Independents' perfect season was over. And it seemed like so were their chances at the professional football championship, or so many people thought. Well, the team went on to win six of the remaining seven games and played the famous Pine Village Athletic Club to a 0-0 tie to finish the season at 9 wins, 1 loss, and 1 tie, while outscoring your opponents 309-12. Now, the season was a huge success, and by beating the teams from Cincinnati, Columbus, and Akron, the Independents did achieve their goal of gaining national recognition. Especially those big wins, you know, the Columbus Panhandles, they manhandled 49-0, and the Akron Indians, well, they blanked them 17-0 as well, and they were extremely impressive in those wins. Now, Flanagan decided to try and capitalize on the popularity of his team that was riding high, and then he challenged the Canton Bulldogs to a championship game in quotation marks. Now, apparently, the Canton 11 seemed intrigued at first. However, a day later, Jim Thorpe, who was coaching and the star of that team, expressed his players, and many of them had already left town, and since they figured that their season had ended. So Flanagan retorted by even offering $5,000 guaranteed if the Bulldogs would come to Rock Island for the contest. Pretty big money for that time in the game of football. But Canton, which had already won that mythical Ohio League championship by defeating their arch rivals, the Massillon Tigers, had nothing to gain from this game, so they turned down that offer with Thorpe's call. Now, American fandom speculates that Canton's Jim Thorpe and Ralph Hay, the owner of the club, learned that Rock Island's game against Akron Indians had only drawn 1,700 spectators, and they felt that Flanagan could not deliver on his $5,000 guarantee, because most of that money, they figured, would come primarily from the gate receipts of the game. Now, historian Bob Carroll of the PFRA, in his great post, thought that possibly Canton team figured they had nothing to prove in the contest, as they had just proven that they were the best team in the mythical Ohio League. You know, that was the thought to be the standard of professional football in that era. And despite the decline of the Bulldogs, Flanagan, ever being the great promoter of his team, claimed the Independents to be the champions of the USA for the PFRA Coffin Corner article by Bob Carroll and Bob Braunwart a few decades ago. Now, this contract with the Bulldogs and even George Halas did pay some dividends in the coming years, though. It gave an invitation to join a group of franchises that would make professional football history just a year later when they would organize into the precursor of the NFL, the American Professional Football Association. We'll talk more about that next week in part two of this story on Rock Island and our early pro football history lessons here that we get on PigskinDispatch.com. Remember, we talk about football history every day, not just pro history, but college and the high school levels too. And we'd love to have your feedback at pigskindispatch@gmail.com. Till tomorrow, everybody, have a great gridiron day. We're taking a peek over at the chains and the down marker. It's fourth and long. We're going to have to punt the ball and get on out of here, but we'll have another series tomorrow for your football history headlines, so be sure to tune in. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. PigskinDispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast. PigskinDispatch.com is a proud affiliate of the Sports History Network, the headquarters of sports yesteryear.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, is found right here on the Sports History Network.